From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me you've built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Well, the way I see it, if you're going to build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style? You've got to come back with me.
Back where? Back to the future.
Then tell me, future boy, who's the president of the United States in 1985?
It's Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan, the actor? Who's vice president? Jerry Lewis? Boy, you've got to come back.
Back where? Back to the future on 30 Laps.
So, this week, it's everything DeLorean. Well, John DeLorean, actually. And we'll talk about his wonderful rises and failures. And Great Scott, a new DeLorean. And if we've got time, the ins and out of owning a DMC DeLorean motor car. It's all back to the future this week on 30 Laps. So, let's get cracking, shall we? From Forbes magazine, Chuck Tennant writes, he sold Americans a sexy new vision of speed and luxury, but while his final creation took flight in Back to the Future, in real life it crumpled amid scandal. John Zachary DeLorean was indisputably a brilliant engineer, a flamboyant, aggressive business executive who burst out of the staid yes-men culture of the 1950s. He would prove to be an early model of the modern American visionary. Think Jobs, Bezos, Zuckerberg, who discarded convention in pursuit of a singular vision. In his case, that meant trying to create the greatest sports car the world had ever seen. He was also accused of being a thief, a fraud, an embezzler, and a brazen con man who fooled everyone he ever did business with, from celebrities to superpowers, bilking them out of millions of dollars in the process. DeLorean's long-time attorney and staunch personal advocate, Howard Weitzman, told the Los Angeles Times after the car maker's death in 2005 that John DeLorean had one of the most warped views of right and wrong he had ever come across. So how did the man behind America's first muscle car become a figure with such a tormented and tortured legacy? Because much like the car he's most famous for, the DMC-12, a cultural icon thanks to its featured role in Back to the Future movies, he's both celebrated for his sleek fantasy vision of the future and widely mocked for his spectacular and sordid failures. The son of an immigrant factory worker, or factory workers, John Zachary DeLorean was born January 6, 1925, and grew up in a primarily working-class neighbourhood on the east side of Detroit. His father, Zachary, was a union organiser and foundry worker at the Ford Motor Company. Drive Tribe, an online community platform for auto enthusiasts, reported that his poor English and problems with alcohol prevented him from ever progressing past the factory floor. John's mother, Catherine, worked for General Electric and tried to keep things together at home. Hemmings Daily reported that when things got particularly rough, she would whisk the boys away to her sister's home in Los Angeles. It has been speculated that John developed a love for the California lifestyle during these escapes. His education was interrupted by World War II. He served in the army, but he eventually earned a master's in automotive engineering and later an MBA from the University of Michigan. He officially began his automotive career in 1952, joining the research and development team at the Packard Motor Company. Before long, he became a rising star in the company and the industry. In 1956, DeLorean took a position at General Motors as an engineer in the Pontiac division. At the time, GM was the biggest company in the world and the place to be. But Pontiac struggled with its brand identity and wasn't connecting with America's youth. Suddenly, a huge new consumer force driving the country's emerging car culture. Pontiac seemed to make only stuffy cars for older adults. Pontiac was really in trouble, says J. Patrick Wright, author of On a Clear Day, You Can See General Motors, the best-selling tell-all book about the auto giant. It was like an old person's division. When DeLorean left, he says, it became the third best nameplate in the auto industry, right behind Chevrolet and Ford. While other GM executives focused on building stately automobiles that seemed to float down the street on a cloud, DeLorean had different plans. He wanted to replace those sedate rides with sportier vehicles, machines that embraced a youth culture and more interested in going fast than being cosy. When Pete Est took over the reins of Pontiac in 1961 and DeLorean was named division's chief engineer, he seized the opportunity by having his engineering team throw a big 389 cubic inch V8 engine from a full-size Pontiac Bonneville into a mid-size Pontiac Tempest. The result was a manoeuvrable but brawny car with racing-friendly surplus of power and torque. DeLorean called it the Pontiac Tempest Le Mans GTO, and it created a new category of automobile that would come to be known as the muscle car. But GM had a strict mandate prohibiting its engineers from sticking big engines in smaller cars to make them go fast. So the top executives at GM would never have approved the GTO as conceived. As captured in Framing John DeLorean, a new film directed by Dunn Argot, it's told in documentary style with dramatic reenactments, starring Alec Baldwin as DeLorean and a supporting cast of top Hollywood character actors. The engineer came up with a loophole and Est's approval, of course, to justify the high-performance aspect of the car. Instead of selling the car as a standalone model, the larger engine would be offered as a $295 option package on the 1964 Tempest. GTO-equipped coupes started at $2,852 and the convertibles at $3,081. The GTO package was an instant hit. Orders poured in. GM went on to sell 32,450 GTOs in its first year of production. One thing you could never accuse John DeLorean of was hiding in his shell. But let's get back to the story. For this blatant act of defiance, DeLorean was handsomely rewarded, leapfrogging in 1965 ahead of several promising engineers with more seniority to become the youngest general manager of Pontiac at the age of 40. 4 years later, he was named the youngest manager of Chevrolet, and in 1972, he was made the head of GM's North American car and truck operations. Not only was DeLorean a great engineer, he cultivated a talent for marketing as well. He understood something other than auto industry executives hadn't even grasped yet. Automobiles were just about as much about style as they were about nuts and bolts. None of these guys were paying attention to the fashion side, Wright says. After DeLorean gave us the Firebird, his reputation took flight well beyond Detroit. Before the GTO, DeLorean's lifestyle had conformed to GM's image of an executive. He kept his hair short and clean, wore conservative three-piece suits, was married, and attended the right social functions. That all changed after the muscle car was born. Now he was a rock star, making the money of one and living the lifestyle. He started working out, wearing trendy clothes, and in 1968 divorced his first wife, Elizabeth Higgins, after 14 years of marriage, to spend more time on the West Coast. There he hobnobbed with Hollywood's elite and dated models and actresses like Ursula Andre, Joey Hetherington, and Tina Sinatra. This new DeLorean was brash and even more arrogant and turned his nose up at GM's elite. And they had a love-hate relationship with him because of it. He was successful for not doing what they told him to, and instead following his own instincts, Wright says. The divisions were making money, and a lot of the profit ended up in the bonuses of those executives at the end of the year. They loved their bonuses, even as they grew to dislike DeLorean. It became a catch-22 of greed. In 1969, DeLorean married actress Kelly Harmon, the sister of actor Mark Harmon, of NCIS fame, and the daughter of Tom Harmon, a college football legend, war hero, and sportscaster. Kelly was 20, DeLorean 44. The couple adopted a son, Zachary, but continued to lead the jet-set lifestyle, shunning the worlds and the social scene in Detroit. If his lifestyle hadn't rankled his colleagues already, his push for significant changes at GM, such as abandoning big cars in favour of smaller, more fuel-efficient models, was sacrilegious. By the spring of 1973, it all changed. Harmon and DeLorean had divorced. Then came the infamous Greenbrier presentation. DeLorean was set to give a confidential speech to 700 top GM executives at the triennial Greenbrier Hotel GM Management Conference in West Virginia. The topic? How the poor quality of cars they are producing was hurting GM's bottom line. The speech was very critical. His staff insisted he tone it down, which he did. But an unedited copy of the presentation mysteriously leaked and was published by the Detroit News. Both his supporters and his detractors at GM turned on him. DeLorean resigned in April 1973. 6 months later, he told the New York Times that he didn't want the job anyway because a top management post at GM consists of sitting in meetings all day. Even at $650,000 a year, if the job's not satisfying, yeah, do something else, he said. 5 weeks later, and the flamboyant automaker had already begun a new life, one free from the shackles of Detroit. He'd married supermodel Christina Ferrer in a private ceremony in Los Angeles, and they promptly set up house in New York City. She was 23, he was 48. DeLorean also started working on plans to form a car company. The DeLorean Motor Company was officially founded October 24, 1975, in Detroit. The plan was to build what DeLorean called an ethical car, a car that was safe, long-lasting, and sustainable. He envisioned a car that would be the best of everything, says Jordan Livingston, a documentary filmmaker finishing a project on the automaker entitled Living the Dream. He wanted the best style, he wanted the best environment impact, he wanted the best value for the customer, and he wanted the best safety. Within 2 years, the company had created a mid-engine prototype to draw investors. Bill Collins, a former colleague at Pontiac, who was a key player in the creation of the GTO, engineered the first prototype for what would become the DMC-12. But DeLorean bought Colin Chapman, the charismatic, flashy founder of Lotus, to re-engineer the chassis and suspension. Collins was soon summarily dispatched.
Yesterday, I was up before the dawn, and I really have enjoyed my stay, but I must be moving on. Like a king without a castle, like a queen.
Yeah, well, it wasn't Goodbye Stranger. It was just plain goodbye. Back to the story, folks. This is Richard Lyon, 30 Laps with Dick, and we're 15 minutes into our talk today on John DeLorean. And yet the car's design drew backers. The coupe's iconic look was created by Giorgetto Guigario, the Italian designer and founder of Ital Design, who was behind such classics as the Alfa Romeo Iguana concept car, the Lotus Esprit, the Ferrari 250 GT, SWB Bertone, the Tech Rules Ren, and many others. He based the DeLorean on a 1970 concept car he had drawn up for Porsche, which was similarly wedge-shaped and most importantly featured a stainless steel body with gull-wing doors. Its power came from a rear-mounted Peugeot Renault Volvo 2.85-litre V6 that produced 130 horsepower. Seed capital came quickly as the DeLorean took a Bank of America loan and turned to entertainers like Tonight Show Johnny Carson, Roy Clark and Sammy Davis Jr. for additional investors. He also raised money through a program that helped dealerships selling DeLorean car shares in the company. DeLorean went looking for government development funds to build a factory. In February 1978, Business Week reported that the company had been flirting with Canada, Spain, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and most recently his hometown Detroit. But after inking a preliminary agreement with the U.S. Department of Commerce and the government of Puerto Rico to build a factory on a former Air Force base, and his brother, DeLorean, received a better offer from the British government to build a factory in Northern Ireland on a cow pasture in Dunmurry, just outside Belfast, right in the heart of the bloody conflict between Ireland's Catholic and Protestant communities. Total investment, more than $100 million in British government loans and loan guarantees, and tens of millions from private investors. Everything seemed to be in place. Except all that money would disappear very fast. The biggest problem we had was the first business plan was developed once the project had come to Northern Ireland, made it quite clear we're going to run out of money the day we produced the first car, said Barry Wills, author of John Z, The DeLorean, and Me, Tales from an Insider, who was DMC's Director of Purchasing and Supply at the time, and its final CEO. We always knew that, and that's why we were constantly under pressure to try and persuade the British government to give us a little bit more money, but it wasn't forthcoming. 7 months after breaking ground in Belfast, Margaret Thatcher's Conservative Party came to power in Britain. She did not approve of the deal that the Labour Party had struck with the American. She frowned upon any government investment in what she considered to be private industry. Then in 1981, the first wave of cars had quality control issues, which led to a bad press in the US critics, and which led to bad press in the US. Critics were thrilled with how the car looked, but the car was underpowered, offered so-so handling, and was neither as groundbreakingly safe nor as fuel-efficient as DeLorean had promised it would be. The money crisis grew. A plan emerged to restructure the company and take it public as the DeLorean Motor Holdings Company. The proposed stock offering would have personally enriched DeLorean, the company's majority shareholder, by around $120 million, but would have left everyone else holding only options, like the car dealers who had joined the dealer investment program with next to nothing. It would be particularly a bad deal for Margaret Thatcher and the British government. Thatcher was outraged, Livingston says, and she cut off any further investment in the American company, placing the Belfast plant in receivership. In the end, only 9,000 DMC-12s were built, approximately 6,000 of which were sold to consumers. Well, he had to give them a little bit, I guess.
Yeah.
would appear it was all running out. Even so, DeLorean assured DMC executives that the money was on its way back. Back then, Livingston said, the Irish in Belfast would believe anything DeLorean said. When John DeLorean came to inspect the troops, it might as well have been George Clooney or Brad Pitt visiting the factory floor, even. I think they only had one factory floor, not four factory floors. Anyway, that's another floor there. Livingston says he was this rock star with a supermodel on his arm. People were absolutely starstruck. To this day, many still consider the Floored Auto exec. See, there's floor again. That's four floors now. That Floored Auto exec to be a saviour, no matter what he is said to have done. Everybody, from the taxi drivers to the bartenders to hotel clerks, everybody had something to say about John, says Livingston, who recently attended a reunion of DMC workers and their families. He left an incredible stamp on the community. Why? Well, working at DMC was not only the first job for most, explains Livingston, but it was also one of the highest paying and most meaningful jobs they ever had. He came into a place that had almost 80% unemployment, created jobs, skilled jobs, and jobs that people would be proud of. As for his investors, Will says, a group in the US led by financier Jeannie Farnan was allegedly raising money for the company. And according to a report in the Washington Post, Farnan claimed to have located investors willing to put up $10 million as part of the financial package to rescue the firm, shortly before the government-appointed receivers planned to declare the DeLorean company defunct. She forwarded the final loan documents to DeLorean on the morning of October 19, 1982, the last day for the company to either obtain new funding or face liquidation. It was too good to be true. It was money the receivers would have never accepted, Wills says. According to the Washington Post, Farnan is facing a criminal investigation by the FBI and the US Attorney General's Office in Washington. Farnan eventually served 5 months on criminal contempt charges. DeLorean never signed the papers, though. He apparently had another plan. Wills went home after a long day at the office, had a meal and settled in for the night. He got a call around 8 p.m. from one of the company's new British government overlords, telling him to call the workforce together as well and close up the shop for good. It came as a shock. We'd kept all the key people together in the hope that the company would be restructured, that the funds would be found in one way or another to bring it back to life again, Wills said. He knew things were dire, but he didn't understand the sudden rush. He would come to understand it the following morning. He turned up on the BBC and learned that DeLorean had been arrested in a videotaped sting by the FBI, during which he allegedly agreed to a scheme to sell 220 pounds of cocaine worth an estimated $24 million in the hope it would provide enough cash to keep his company afloat. Wills had to face the workers after hearing the news. They were grown men in tears, he said. In less than 24 hours, the staff had gone from being told the money was on its way to seeing their boss, whom they adored, either in spite of or because of his bravado, arrested on drug charges. A week later, DMC filed for bankruptcy. During the trial that followed, DeLorean's attorney, Howard Weitzman, argued that the FBI had been able to entrap the desperate automaker because they knew he would do anything to save his business. And the evidence suggests that Weitzman had a point. According to multiple reports at the time, the deal was presented to DeLorean by a paid FBI informant. When DeLorean said he didn't have the cash to pay for the drugs up front, the informant promised to arrange the financing as long as he would put up company as collateral, and although he showed intent, he never took possession of the drugs. It seems he never planned to pay for them either. The cocaine deal was just another business venture into which DeLorean was not putting a dime of his own money. The government believed his agreement to hand over control of his company constituted proof of his willingness to participate. But DeLorean did not give them control of the DeLorean Motor Cars Limited or DeLorean Motor Company. Instead, he agreed to provide them with control of DMC Incorporated, a dormant shell company that had no assets. DeLorean was conning the conmen, and he may have been lucky. They were fake. The Medellin cartel, for example, might not have been very amused with the ruse. After less than 30 hours of deliberation, DeLorean was acquitted on all charges. His legal woes, though, were only beginning, and he faced trials for embezzlement and fraud by federal prosecutors and investigation by British authorities. He was never convicted, but accountants did recover almost $100 million for the creditors of the DeLorean Motor Company in civil court over the course of nearly two decades. Driven into bankruptcy, DeLorean had to sell his home in New Jersey, where he had nearly 500-acre estate, and was eventually purchased by Donald Trump and converted into Trump National Golf Club, which he frequently visits as president. Along the way, DeLorean's family also fell apart, as Farrar left him and he was acquitted of the cocaine charges, taking her daughter, Catherine, and Zachary with her. There were definitely immediate effects, says Zachary, who's now 47. I mean, how the hell couldn't there be? DeLorean died March 19, 2005, at the Overlook Hospital in Summit, New Jersey, from a complication after a stroke. He was 80 and had been living in a one-bedroom apartment in Bedminster with his fourth wife, Sally. Today, Zachary DeLorean no longer blames his father. We all make decisions in life, and some of them are right and some of them are wrong, he says. When asked about his father's legacy, though, Zach is divided, as is everyone else. On one hand, I feel proud of my father, he says. On the other hand, I just want to blow the effing thing up. What a story, hey? That'd make a great book, just like Mr. Goshen from last couple of weeks ago. This was written by Chuck Tennant, and it came from Forbes magazine, and it took our whole show up today, folks. Still, I think it was a great story and worth devoting an episode of 30 Laps to. He was one of the great motor mouths of the motor industry and deserves his place on the 30 Laps Roll of Honour for motor mouths in 2020. Thanks very much for your company today. I've really enjoyed, as usual, talking to you, and I hope we can get together next week from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is Richard Lyon, 30 Laps with Dick. And we'll talk again next week. Bye for now.